Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Changing the Game, My Career in Collegiate Sports Marketing, came out in hardback in March of 2020, and like so many events that occurred last year, the release of the memoir of Jim Host, written with Eric Moyen, was overshadowed by the pandemic. The paperback version was just released by the University Press of Kentucky, and given the impact that this man has had, he's been called the Daniel Boone of college sports, we realize that there is just no way to contain the story of Jim Host in a 12-minute segment, so we've invited him to join us for the hour. And even that couldn't contain the full interview. You'll find that on our site at esweku.org. What follows is a version edited to fit the Eastern Standard time frame. Jim Host, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Glad to be with you, Tom.
And I'd like to begin with your beginnings, detailed in Chapter 1 of the book, born in November of 37 in Kane, Pennsylvania, to parents whose families could not have been more different. Let's explore that just a little bit, because I think it'll help our listeners get to know you. So first, what was your mom's family like?
My mother came from a family of 15, 12 sisters, 3 brothers. My grandfather was the first Chevrolet dealer in western Pennsylvania. And my grandfather was a great salesperson. He was a great disciplinarian. And then my dad's family, he was born in Comstock Park, Michigan, which is a little town outside of Grand Rapids. They were part of a family that had immigrated from Germany, and they were German to a core. My dad was Catholic. My mother was Methodist. And guess what? We grew up as Methodists. That tells you who the strongest person in the family was. Mm-hmm. My dad was a very stoic, hard shell disciplinarian who ruled with a razor strap and who never made more than $8,000 a year in his life, kept track of every penny. To this day, I don't know how we made it, but we did.
Your family moved around quite a bit when you were young, and you started school in the Seneca Nation town of Salamanca in western New York, and you say that's where you developed this lifetime love of baseball. How did that happen?
I used to listen to every single baseball game that was on the radio as long as I can remember when I was 6 or 7 years old. I think that came a lot from my dad. He took me to see games. I would ride my bike to the park, which was well down the street from where we lived on Academy Boulevard in Salamanca. And there was no Little League then. There was no Babe Ruth League. It was all pickup games. I loved that. And I would play all day. And I kept statistics of every single Major League Baseball player. I could tell you when I was 9 and 10 years old of who was leading the leagues and hitting. And so today, I couldn't tell you because they move around too much.
Your family lived for a time in the Virginia town of Iron Gate in Paw Paw, West Virginia. And finally, you found yourself in Ashland, Kentucky, where George Conley, who you describe in your book as one of the meanest, toughest coaches ever, became a major influence in your life. How so?
Well, I never saw anybody who ever intimidated players or coached players harder than he did in high school. And I wanted to be a high school basketball player. And I also was already pretty good in baseball. I was pitching with much older people when I was in the 9th grade and in the 8th grade. And so I came out for the team when I got to my sophomore year in high school. And he immediately came up to me and said, you can shoot well, but you can't run. I want you to be my team manager because you are passionate about the game, but you're too good in baseball. I don't want you to hurt your arm, and I want you to help me with this team. So I became his team manager as a sophomore and as a junior. And then when he left after the junior year, I tried out again and thought I was going to be the starting center until somebody underbridged me and I fell in on my left arm and dislocated my shoulder so bad that it was almost beyond repair. And so I couldn't play basketball. So I became the team manager again and coached a high school team that ended up winning a high school championship. I'm talking about intramural championship. But I've always had a great love for both baseball and basketball and college football.
Then you arrive in Lexington and at UK in the fall of 1955, a first-generation college student, I believe, correct?
There had never been in the history of my family, all the way back through the beginning of time, nobody on my mother's side or my dad's side ever to go to college. I was lucky enough to be able to throw a baseball pretty well and got one of the first 2 full scholarships ever given at Kentucky in baseball.
So you were aspiring to become a major league pitcher. In the meantime, though, you found radio and became a sportscaster for the campus station and also for WVLK. Looking back on it, were these dual passions converging into a path toward sports marketing?
When I was in high school, I loved the play-by-play announcers in baseball. I remember listening to Harry Carey when he was with the St. Louis Cardinals, well before the Cubs, and Rosie Rosewell, who was with the Pittsburgh Pirates, and Jack Brickhouse, who was a Cubs announcer. And I would go down the street and describe leaves on the trees as if I was doing play-by-play walking. And so I made up my mind that if I ever got to college, I would major in radio and television, if that was available, and play. And obviously, that's what I did.
You mentioned that you played semi-pro baseball for what had been an all-black team in Lexington. And in the summer of 1956, and that's an important year to remember here, you were unaware of the significance of being a white guy joining an African-American team.
Well, I grew up in Ashland. We were right across the river from Ironton, and Ironton was integrated and Ashland was segregated. But we played in high school against teams that had black kids. And again, there was no Little League then, and so I would ride my bike down South 29th Street to Central Park, and I played with a lot of black kids, and I played with a lot of Catholic kids, and all the schools were separate then. But I never, not only didn't know the difference, didn't care about the difference. Mm. All I wanted to do was play with the best. And normally, it would always be a black kid or a Catholic kid who would be the ones I'd choose first as opposed to a kid that I went to school with.
You put a lot of time, a lot of effort, a lot of hope and aspiration into minor league baseball. You were chasing that dream of taking to the mound in the majors. And then came Cedar Rapids. Tell us what happened in Cedar Rapids.
Well, I had started with Holdridge in the Nebraska State League in 1959 in a White Sox organization. Reported there with 72 others. I thought I would be one of 18 reporting, and I wasn't. So I had to be competitive, and I was, and made the roster of the team. Had on that team three future major leaguers who made the major leagues. And halfway through the year, I got promoted to Class B ball, which today would be Double A, and at Lincoln in the 3I League. And the last game of the year at Cedar Rapids, I was blowing and going. I had probably 16 or 17 strikeouts and had the other team in the palm of my hand. And I came out in the eighth inning, bottom of the eighth, and threw, and it went up into the screen. And the manager, who was a former major league pitcher, Ira Hutchinson, came out and he said, "What'd you do?" And I said, "I don't know." By that time, I could feel there was something wrong with my arm. And I had blown what they called the deltoid strap. Today, it would be the labrum. I didn't know that, and they didn't have anything to fix it. So I went in. By the time I got to the locker room, I couldn't lift my arm. So they sent me to a best doctor in the Lincoln area after the next day, and he shot it full of cortisone, and he said, "Go home and rest it. You'll be fine in the spring." Well, to this day, I still can't throw because I'd never had it operated on. So my career in baseball was finished.
So you went back into radio. Now you're in Frankfort, and one day there, you got a call that might be called life-altering. On the line was one of the most successful businessmen in Kentucky history, Jarvis Kincaid. Tell us about that.
Well, Jarvis Kincaid was an icon already. He had formed Central Bank. He had just purchased Kentucky Central Life Insurance. He got his fortune through Kentucky Finance and a number of other things. He was just a brilliant person. And so I did not know in those years you couldn't own more than one radio station in a particular geographical area. Well, he owned FKY in Frankfort, EKY in Richmond, HIR in Danville, WWKY in Winchester, all under somebody else's name. So I was working in Frankfort with Kenny Hart and Bud McLean, and I was doing play-by-play there, and he heard me. And he calls and he said, "Host, this is Kincaid. Be in my office tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. And he hung up. I had no idea who Kincaid was. And so I said to Bud McLean, "Who's Kincaid?" He said, "That's the guy that owns the station." And I said, "Oh, well, he just called me and said, be in his office tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. He said, "What for?" I said, "I don't have a clue." So I went to his office the next day, and I remember like it was yesterday. He was in a second floor or third floor of Central Bank building, which was on Short Street then, and sitting behind his desk with a huge bowl of chocolate ice cream and chocolate sauce on it, and a big, huge napkin in front of him, and so on. And didn't have anybody in the room with him, and he said, I've listened to you. He said, you're pretty good. He said, I want you to take over doing the color work on the Kentucky Central Network. And I said, what's that? And he said, well, it's a network I've started to try to get Kentucky Central associated with UK throughout the state. I want you to build the network. I want you to work the network. And you can work in sales at BLK, and you can be on the air at BLK. And you'll get $375 a month, and the rest is up to you. And that was the end of the conversation. And I said, do I have any alternative? He said, not if you want to work for me. And so I walked out, and I called Bud McLean, who was the station manager, and told him what had happened. And I reported to BLK the next day to Ted Grizzard, who was the station manager, and became a play-by-play voice for high school stuff there, became working behind Claude Sullivan, who was the voice of UK Standard Oil Network, one of five originations. And so the Kentucky Central Network didn't originate in Lexington because they didn't want anything to compete with Standard Oil with VLK. So I had to go out and help build the network statewide. Anyway, Hal Rogers was the afternoon disc jockey, and I was the evening disc jockey. Hal Rogers, now the current congressman from the 5th District, which began a long, lifelong friendship that we've had. And Dee Huddleston, who became United States Senator, was the play-by-play voice. And at the end of the football season, he said, Jim, he said, you do a great job. He said, why don't you just take this over and do the whole network yourself? I'm not interested in continuing to do basketball. I don't want to travel. And I said, okay. So I became the play-by-play voice, the engineer, the producer. I carried all the equipment. I hooked up all the equipment. I cleared all the stations. I would go out and call on all the stations while I was still trying to sell at BLK during the day and be on the air at night.
Did you sleep?
I can't sleep fast enough. I still can't.
So all this kind of led to you spending time with Adolph Rupp.
Yep.
How did he make a mark on your life and career?
I've only met two people in my life who I was in real awe of. One of them was him, and the other was Walter Byers. And Coach Rupp could have been a CEO of any business in the country. He was that bright, talented, and he was one of the funniest, wittiest guys I've ever been around in my life. And you talk about somebody that ran practice with authority. He would stand in the middle of the floor, blow his whistle, and he would say, if you can improve upon the silence, say something. He wanted total silence, total dedication to the plays and the discipline, and that's why his teams were as good as they were.
So you went to work for Procter & Gamble, and at age 25, you found yourself head salesman in P&G's Washington office, presiding over three sales units, 25 employees. But your family was back in Kentucky, and in time, you decided you needed to return to Lexington. No job, no idea what you would do. You got into real estate and insurance, representing John Gaines when he sold part of Gainesway Farm to develop Merrick Inn. That was followed by home building and the Gainesway development in Cardinal Valley, and then back into radio, sportscasting for WLAP, and then forming one of the largest insurance agencies in Lexington, and then running Senator John Sherman Cooper's campaign in Fayette County. So politics. Was this a turning point in your professional life, and what important lessons did you take away from observing Senator Cooper?
Probably the best politician in terms of a pure country politician I ever met. And he would take the train from Washington to Lexington, and I would meet him, and he always had a little flask of bourbon with him, and we would go to his hotel room. He always stayed at the Downtowner Hotel, downtown Lexington, which is not there anymore. And we would sit and talk, and every time that he and I would talk, there would be a lesson to it. And he was an unbelievably, a very humble man, but a terrific, terrific communicator in terms of politics and his understanding of it. If there was a Republican response to John Kennedy, he was it in terms of the way he came across. He was not a right wing or a left wing. He totally taught me that you have to look at every issue not on what it is good for the party or good for you. Is it good for the Commonwealth, and is it good for the country? And I've always operated under that model ever since he told me that. It's why I have trouble today with the ideology of what's separating our country. Shouldn't be red and blue. Should be red, white, and blue for the entire country. So I learned how to speak from him politically. I learned how to handle people politically from him. one thing he told me, which carried on in my business. Never tell anybody who asks you to do something no. He said, listen to them, listen to what they say, and say, I'll do everything I can to help you. And then do what you can to help them, but then tell them you're doing everything you can. Take it the second time, take it the third time, and then tell them that you couldn't get it done. If you handle yourself that way, everybody will know you've done your best, even if you couldn't get it done.
And then Louis B. Nunn, and making a very long story short here, again, Nunn got you to help him become governor and then tried to reward you in a way that made you kind of uncomfortable. Can you tell us about that?
Well, first of all, because of Senator Cooper, I supported Judge Marlo Cook in the primary because I had responsibility for Senator Cooper for Central Kentucky, and I had the same thing for Judge Cook, and we beat the dickens out of Louis Nunn in this area, even though Don Ball was his chairman in this area, and Don Ball was a very powerful House minority leader then in the House of Representatives, and who ended up becoming one of my best friends. And anyway, the day after the primary that Louis won by a very small amount over Judge Cook, he called me. And he said, anybody that could beat me like you did in that county, I want for me. I said, I'm for you. I'm Republican, and I'll be for you. And so he used me a great deal during the campaign. I traveled a lot with him. I became kind of not an alter ego, but certainly somebody that listened to him and gave him my advice. He was a very, very astute, smart political guy, very witty, very funny. He learned a lot from Senator Cooper, too. We used to talk about Senator Cooper. And obviously then he won the governor's race, offered me the first post to be a cabinet head. I had a insurance business that I had two partners in, so I had to say I've got to separate myself from those, because the way it worked in state government in those days, it was whoever gave the most amount of political money usually got the contract. So partially through my term, as I was first commissioner of public information, which was tourism and economic development communications, I became commissioner of parks, which I really loved. I got a love affair with parks then. And there were 9 cabinet heads, of which parks and public information were 2 of the 9. So about 3 weeks after I was there, there was a individual that I couldn't understand why, when we had wind damages and water damages at docks in western Kentucky, why one contractor would get the job the first time and another one the second time and another one the third time. So I smelled something. I asked all of our people in the cabinet what was going on. They said they didn't know. I later found out they did. So I called the commissioner of public safety, Bill Newman, and asked him to do a private investigation for me without telling the governor's office or anybody, because I smelled it had to do with what was doing with money and politics. And so as a result, he came to me. I was playing in a golf tournament in Owensboro and came out on a golf course. And he said, Commissioner, I've got the answer for you, and it's not good. And he told me that one of the employees that is in western Kentucky that was in charge of that district was selling the fact that he would make the decision on a 3. So they would fix the bids properly. And he had a guy in the finance cabinet was in cahoots with him. And Newman had all that evidence. And so I went back to my office, picked the phone up, and I fired the guy. And I said, you're fired. You're put on leave, but you're fired. And you won't ever work again while I'm here. And he said, well, Commissioner, you can't do that. And I said, well, the last time I checked, I'm Commissioner of Parks. I think I can do what the hell I want to do to keep this thing legitimately honest. And he said, no, you can't. You'll find out. And I said, well, I'll tell you what. If you want to call your friend in the governor's office, you tell him to tell the governor if he wants me to leave, I will. But in the meantime, I'm going to go up on press row and tell him what happened. And I got another thing I'm going to do. I'm going to tell the head of LRC, who was Democrat, Don Harkins, who I'd gotten to know well. I said, I'm going to bring him into my conference and tell him what's going on so the legislature knows. Now, next step is yours. And so obviously, they didn't take me up on my thing, and I did fire him, and I did call all the department heads of my cabinet in and say, I want you all to know something. We're not going to run this like it's been run. This is how this is going to be done, at least in this cabinet. That's all I got control over. Well, the governor, Louis, called a cabinet meeting. He never called cabinet meetings. He called a cabinet meeting. And I can remember this like yesterday. And the two guys that were the bag men in his office were sitting over in the corner with, you know, obviously daggers. If they could have used their eyes, they would have killed me. And the governor said, we're indebted to Commissioner Hoste for keeping us in the first major scandal this administration would have had. And that was the whole purpose of the meeting. And I said, thank you, Governor. And I got up and walked out. And one of these two guys said, if you ever run for office, we're going to kill you. And I said, look, my best guess is I'll never run for office. But if I do, take me on. And so that's what happened.
Your trip with Governor Nunn to Kentucky Village, yeah, which was a prison for juveniles, resulted in Nunn breaking a promise and led to you helping Nunn fight for, well, I'll let you tell the story.
What I saw made me vomit. It was horrible. Feces on the floor, filth, and so on. And he was visibly upset to the point of tears, and he said, we can't tolerate this. Previous administration had left a cupboard bare, and there was $24 million in debt and no money to pay. And he said, I've got no way to do anything except to raise the sales tax. And he said, when I do that, he said, I'll never be able to win again, and he didn't. And he said, they'll put it around my neck, and they will. And he said, but I'm going to send Ivan Jett, who's one of the smartest guys I know, over to see you, and the two of you, I want you to put a game plan together for how we're going to raise the sales tax from 3 cents to 5 cents, which ultimately became called Nunn's Nickel. So we did that under the cloak of darkness and night. Nobody knew what we were doing. We would come and report to them, and we put together a very solid game plan. Here's a Republican governor with a hugely majority Democrat Senate and a hugely majority Democrat House, and a Democrat lieutenant governor. So fighting all the way along the way, and yet we got it done to be able to pass. But he had a lot of guts, and he knew what it was going to do to him politically. But we passed what became called Nunn's Nickel, and it's to me, he's one of the greatest governors the state ever had.
You were there for the beginning of KET, the strategies that resulted in the Kentucky Horse Park, chairing the Horse Park Authority, adding a fifth floor to the grandstands at Churchill Downs to meet the security needs of high-profile politicians and dignitaries. You got involved in the travel industry in a big way and their promotion of tourism across the Southeast. You ran the State Parks Department. You raised funds to preserve the Mary Todd Lincoln House, Henry Clay's original law office, and Whitehall, the former home of Cassius Marcellus Clay. You were central in the complicated creation of Rupp Arena and what is now known as Central Bank Center. And this trajectory goes on and on with so many interesting details and observations. And we haven't even begun talking about college sports marketing. We're going to turn to that in a moment. I'm Tom Martin with Jim Hoste, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
This is Tom Musgrave with the Kentucky Arts Council. Coming up in Central and Eastern Kentucky Arts, the Kentucky Guild of Artists and Craftsmen will host its Stop and Shop Festival Show, 2 p.m. to 8 p.m. August 6th and 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. August 7th at the London Community Center, 529 South Main Street in London. Admission is $5. For more information, visit kyguild.org. And the Rowan County Arts Center will host the Moorhead Market, 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. August 14th on the Arts Center lawn. Shop locally and regionally made and produced food, arts, and crafts. For more information, visit RowanCountyArtsCenter.com. From the Kentucky Arts Council for Eastern Standard, I'm Tom Musgrave.
Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
Jim Hoste is with us this hour. We're looking at highlights from his memoir, Changing the Game, which was first published by the University Press of Kentucky in the midst of the pandemic in 2020 and was just released as a paperback. The details are amazing, and even though we're devoting this hour to discussing it, the book must be read cover to cover to fully appreciate what the man sitting across from me right now has accomplished in his life. So, Jim Hoste, let's talk about how you went about building the UK radio network, which became the largest college sports radio network in the whole country. A lot of legwork, a lot of juggling on the advertising side, lining up affiliate stations, especially some powerful ones, and offering to pay stations to broadcast games. Was that a radical idea?
Yeah, I don't think anybody was doing it. I wanted to get us an affiliate in Cincinnati that would be strong. The strongest 50,000-watt voice was on the top part of the dial. That was University of Cincinnati station, and Gail Catlett had just gone there to be the head coach. So I went to him, to Dave Martin, who was the head of the whole complex of J-Corps stations then, and he was head of WLW. I said, I want to be on one of your 50,000-watt voices. I know I can't be on LW, but I can be on CKY. And he said, no, you can't. I said, no, I'm going to pay you. Oh, and I said, I want the right then to sell the commercial time. Well, you're going to do anything you want if you pay us. So he agreed upon a price, and I paid him. And that was the first time that had ever been done. And then the rest of the stations came on at a 50-50 barter basis. And then as the network grew in popularity, I was able to negotiate more time for us, less time for them. And then I got them paying us, as it turned out, because we developed competition in the various counties. I was very loyal to the people that came on with me first. I traveled to every county in this state. So we built the largest cottage network in the country that way.
And if I understand it, a key to success of all this was the pregame and postgame shows. Was this your idea, or did you build on a concept that already...
The coaches' shows were beginning in some other areas. So this wasn't my idea, but what I did is expand on coaches' interviews. We also developed the first sideline mic anybody ever did in football, where we put a announcer on the sidelines. And it was a crazy idea. We had an engineer whose name was Rick Edwards. And I said one day, I said, why, if walkie-talkies can talk from here to the field, why can't we talk from here to the field with a guy on the air? And he said, you know how we can do that? We can put a coat hanger out the booth, and he said, that should do it. Well, how will that do it? And he told me how it would emit signals. And so anyway, we then put the infamous Dick Gabriel on the sideline, and he became our sideline guy all the way back in those years. There were no sideline reporters in television or radio. In football, it really helped build the audience.
In the book, you tell us that the end of your baseball career taught you how to deal with adversity. Your time at WVLK showed you that you were pretty good at broadcasting, and you discovered that you had a natural gift for sales and working with people, brokering. At P&G, you learned how to run a company. You got into politics and then government, tourism, and travel. Jim Host and Associates took over management of the National Tour Brokers Association. And how that happened is itself quite a long story. All of this was leading up to becoming the agent of change in the relationship between sports and business among university presidents and athletic directors. And it appears to me that the title of your book really plays out after UK made it into the NCAA tournament in 1975, when Ralph Hacker, then on the UK broadcast team with Kaywood Ledford and Rick Edwards, said to you, I wonder if you would have a chance to get the broadcast rights to the NCAA championship. Am I right? Was that a pivotal moment?
Sure was. He asked me to check to see who was doing the broadcast for the national group, which was right next door to us, and it was Mutual Network. And he said, I'll bet you could get the national rights if you wanted them. Because I told him how much money we were paying for the UK rights, which blew everybody away because we were reporting every station. You had to pay $25 for each station and $50 for the originating station. Well, we had almost 100 stations, so you can imagine how much revenue that was for the NCAA each time we did it. Well, none of these schools were reporting all their stations. I mean, they saw a way to be able to save money, so they reported half of them, a quarter of them, and so on. And I knew that, and I knew what some of them were doing, and I reported every one of them. So I went down on the floor, and I asked Tom Jernstedt and Dave Kaywood. Dave Kaywood, by the way, who was the head of communications for the NCAA then, he and Tom were running the NCAA basketball tournament, Division I tournament, by themselves. There was no staff other than the two of them. And so I went down on the floor before the championship game between Kentucky and UCLA. And I said, how much is Mutual paying you for the radio rights? And they said, we're embarrassed to tell you, you're paying us more for Kentucky. I was paying $7,000 for Kentucky. Mutual was paying $3,000 for all the national rights. Huh. And I said, I'll tell you what, I'll give you $30,000 for all the rights, and I'll take over the administration. You'll save a couple of people that are sending out all the administration. I'll put the national network together. I've checked, and Mutual's only got 72 stations on their national radio network. I'll take it all over, and I'll let the originating schools continue to be able to do their own local broadcast, because this is where they can make money at the end of the year. And they all both looked at each other and smiled and didn't say anything. And the next Monday, Walter Byers of the NCAA, who was the czar of college sports, called me. "Host, Walter Byers, be in my office tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. Sounded like Garvish Kincaid earlier. And I said, "Where?" He said, "Shawnee Mission, Kansas. Tomorrow morning, 9 o'clock, sharp. Goodbye." So I had to go get on an airplane and go meet him, and that's how it started.
And from that came another pivotal Byers conversation. What happened then?
Well, he came by the first year we had it. It was at the national championship. It still wasn't called the Final Four. The national championship was held in Philadelphia, and it was Indiana's undefeated team against Michigan, coached by Johnny Orr, 1976 at the Spectrum. It wasn't a sellout. You could shoot a cannon down the street of Philadelphia, never hit anybody who cared about the tournament. And Walter Byers came by, poked me on the shoulder prior to the semifinals on Saturday, and he said, "You've done a pretty good job building the network. You got close to 200 stations." And I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "But you're not making any money, are you?" And I said, "No, sir." He said, "Call me the first of the week and come see me after it's over, and we'll do a better deal for you." So I called him, and I immediately went out to see him, and we became partners. We put a three-year agreement together with a split of the revenue, which ended up becoming something that you couldn't do in a nonprofit with a profit entity. The courts threw that out, and it's part of the whole national legal aspect that people look up on federal law. So anyway, that's how it got started, and from there, we were in Atlanta in 1977, and North Carolina was playing Marquette in a championship game, and it was Al McGuire's last game. And right in front of me, Dave Cabot was standing there, and Wayne Duke was the commissioner of the Big Ten. And he said, "This program looks horrible, Dave. Why did we let it get like this?" And Dave said, "Look, we haven't got enough time. We have to give the program rights to the site." And Bob Kemp was running the Omni Arena in Atlanta. And so he had sold a whiskey ad in it, which was against the rules. And then there was another ad in it that was upside down. And a lot of the statistics were wrong in the program. So I walked around the table and I said, "You guys want me to take that over? I'd be glad to take it over and commit the same revenue you're getting while we're losing money. Well, I'll guarantee revenue," because they were paying the Omni to do the program. And so I said, "I'll guarantee you against loss and I'll do the program." Well, the first year we did the program was 1978. It so happened that Kentucky was playing Duke in the championship game, and I was able to get Ashton Aull to take these programs on statewide and sell them through all of their gas station outlets. And we made $48,000, and the NCAA made $48,000, and I was on my way.
And this took you into the printing business.
Yep, it sure did. And then I decided that I needed to be able to control my own destiny in terms of making sure the quality of the programs was right. So I went to a guy in Winchester and bought our first six-color press, put it out at one of the buildings the train had unoccupied. And from there, we went to Thoroughbred Press, who had become a shareholder of mine in the early days because I couldn't pay him, so I gave him some shares. And Mr. Hayden Kirkpatrick said, "Why don't you buy my company?" And I said, "I will." And so I bought his company, which was a piece of real estate, very valuable real estate out on North Broadway. The real estate was more valuable than the printing. And so we got deeply into the publishing and printing business at the same time.
Was it difficult in those early days to line up sponsorships?
We were nickel and diming it because nobody was really interested in the radio network, so we were barely getting by, and I was leaning on people who I knew. Print program was, again, the same thing because just when I started making money on the Final Four program, and wasn't called a Final Four yet, Willis Casey, who was the AD at North Carolina State, at one of the summer meetings threw a bunch of programs on the table that were first-round programs or were mimeograph sheets. He said, "Are you proud of those?" And I said, "I didn't do them." He said, "That's not my question. Are you proud of them?" And I said, "No." He said, "Well, if you want to keep the championship program, you got to do all these." I said, okay. I had no idea how I was going to do them or anything. But as everything else, we figured it out. I always had good people with me, and I never let anybody outwork me in terms of figuring it out. So we were able to do all the first and second round. And that combination of all of that was the key to getting national sponsors. And then from there, I was able to take my P&G training and remembering Sense Off Label. And I woke up with this one night thinking, you know, if I was able to sell a corporate sponsor the ability to be called the official personal care products of the NCAA and be able to get them good tickets to the championship game and to be able to use the NCAA marks on their merchandise, this ought to be valuable. Nobody had done that. It was just something that came to me as a result of my experience with P&G. And so I went to Walter Byers in 1981. And I said, Walter, it's time for corporate sponsorships. And he said, over my effing dead body. And so I followed up by sending him a missile and sent him another letter and sent him another letter and another letter. And finally, he called me and he said, you know, those letters you've been sending me, why don't you come talk to me about it? That's how it all started.
Well, by 1980, the UK network blanketed the whole state with a roster of stations that included a couple of those big, powerful stations that could be heard in 40 states. But in that year, after all of this that we've talked about, you were outbid and lost control of the UK radio network to an outside company. And when you lost the radio rights to UK sports, many thought your company would fold. But as you note in the book, when one door closes, another one opens, and you proceeded to turn that pretty bitter lemon into lemonade. How did you pull that fat out of the fire?
Well, we were located then in Tudor Square, and I called everybody that were keying the company into this relatively small conference room. They were standing around the walls. And as all of you think, I've called you in to let you go. The answer is, I've called you in to tell you this company's going to launch forward in a dramatic way. We're going to go out and we're going to secure other agreements. We know what we're doing in building networks. We know what we're doing in terms of sponsorships. We know what we're doing in others. So hold on. And those of you that think that I have been difficult in the past in terms of my tenacity, I'm going to be more difficult. And any of you that are interested in taking this ride, I'm here. If any of you want to leave, there's the door. And so obviously they all decided to stay. And from there, we got involved with the Southwest Conference. We got involved with a number of other institutions. And I got involved with Southeastern Conference, got involved with other places. And then Cliff Hagan, they will forget Cliff Hagan calling me saying, Jim, the network's killing me. Can you come in and take it over? And I said, well, I can't do it until I'm legally able to do it. But then I got back involved.
You mentioned early in the book that a powerful fear of failure had been instilled in you at an early age, and you might think that that would leave you with quite an aversion to risk. Is a certain degree of risk acceptable as long as it's calculated?
Well, first of all, I've always had a fear of failure because I want to be able to do it better than anybody. But the fear of failure has caused me also to take entrepreneurial risk on things that I felt like I really understood, that I felt like I could do it better than somebody else, and I felt that I could do it better primarily because of the integrity and character that we always had within our company.
Well, you know that you learned a really important lesson during that time, that no matter how bleak the situation might be, there are solutions as long as people are willing to compromise, communicate, and adapt. And shifting for a moment, back over to your political side, would you say that we're all in dire need of that combination of traits these days?
I sure wish we'd have Senator Cooper, for example. I sure wish we had somebody that was able to lead by example and somebody who understood that the common good is not based upon whether you're red or you're blue, but it's based upon what is the best thing for the Commonwealth and what's the best thing for the United States of America. And we're going to get back to that. This time we're going through at this point is only temporary. If you go back in our history, we've had these kinds of times before. We will go back to that time. And there are some that are beginning to emerge on both sides of the aisle in the Senate and in the House that I think we'll see that. I think we've got one more election to go to root out some of the bad stuff that's happened. And then I think we're going to be back in the kind of position we should be in as a nation.
We certainly would be leaving out something really important to Lexington and to this region if we failed to touch on the World Equestrian Games held at the Kentucky Horse Park in 2010. And if you would give us the highlights of your work with the late Pierce Lyons to make it happen as it did during rocky economic times in this country. And I know you go back with Pierce quite a bit.
I had just established my company, Jim Host & Associates, in a little White House on Main Street. I had 5 employees at that point. We had just started doing UK stuff. We had just started doing the National Tour Brokers Association. We were doing UK. Had a guy who ended up becoming news director for KYT, Buzz Riggins, who was sitting in the back in a kitchen. Had a guy by the name of Bill Bowden, who had been a reporter for the Herald Leader, who was my PR guy, who was in the basement of this little house. And the door, could hear this like it was yesterday. This is James here. And it was an Irishman. And he went out and he said, "I don't have a pot to pee in," he said, "but I'll need your help." And he said, "I just came from Ireland." And he said, "Ireland is in deep trouble politically, and I came to this country to build a business." And he said, "Everybody tells me you're the man." And he said, "I need to do a seminar on gasohol." And I said, "What is gasohol?" And he said, "Well, it's really ethanol. I call it gasohol." And he said, "I can do a seminar on that." And he said, "I've done big business with Guinness." And he gave me all of his background. True Irishman. And so I said, "I'll tell you what, I'll take it on. I'll do it. I get 25% of the net. You get 75% of the net." First year, I made $23,000. The second year, I made $48,000. The third year, I made $100,000. So you know how successful it was. And that event is still going on now, is the Alltech conference that attracts people from all over the world to the Central Bank Lexington Center. And so now Princess Haya, I've convinced her, who was married to Sheikh Maktoum, ruler of Dubai, and she was a sister of the King of Jordan. And Sheikh Maktoum owned a couple of farms here locally. And so I felt that with the horse park that we should go head over heels to get the games. And I was Secretary of Commerce then. And so I met with the general manager. His name was Michael Stone of Federation of Equestrian International. Told him what we could do. And he got in touch with Princess Haya. And we got the games, and the games were coming here in 2010. It was a tremendous artistic success. Wasn't much of a financial success, but if it hadn't been for Pierce Lyons, who I then went to see before the games were going, and I asked him, "Pierce, we've stayed in touch, but he had offered me, he wanted me to be his partner in business." And I said, "No, we'd kill each other." And I said, "But I'll always stay in touch." So we did, and we had a great relationship. It's one of the most entrepreneurial, if not the most entrepreneurial person I ever met in my life. And I said, "I want you to be the corporate sponsor of the World Equestrian Games." And he said, "That's horses, isn't it?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Only 7% of our feed additive is sold to people who have to do with horses." I said, "Pierce, you're missing it." I said, "In England, equestrian is number one, and in Germany, it's number two, next to soccer." And I said, "And the ability of people to be able to come to these games here would mean so much to you, and you would be shocked at what it means to the people of England, which you have got a lot of penetration in, and what it means to people of South Africa, and what it means to people of Argentina, and so on." He immediately said, "Okay, how much for a corporate sponsor?" I said, $5 million. And he said, "Well, how much to be a presenting sponsor?" I said, "You don't want to be the Toyota Games presented by Alltech." "Well, then how about being the title sponsor?" And I said, I didn't have any of this planned. And I said, $10 million. And we were sitting drinking coffee in his office, and this was about a 20-minute conversation. And he said, $10 million? Okay, I'll take it." And I said, "Pierce, we need the money spread over a period of years." He said, "That's no problem. I'd rather do it that way. You want the first $200,000 now?" And so that's what happened, and it became the Alltech World Equestrian Games, and he kept that right then and the next year, next 4 years when it was in France, and then gave it up because FEI wanted way too much then from that point on. But that's how it happened, and he and I had such a close personal relationship. He and his wife, Deidre, are still to this day two of the most valuable citizens that ever settled here.
What a story. Well, shifting gears here, a mixture of new state laws and NCAA rules changes that went into effect early July, have given athletes varying degrees of new protections and opportunities to make money by selling their name, image, and likeness, NIL. What's your opinion of today's NIL world?
Long overdue. The fact that it's a multi-billion dollar business, it's long overdue to allow these kids to be able to make money off of their name, image, and licensing. Now, I think the fact that the NCAA took no position in it or took any leadership in it is dead wrong, because it's the wild, wild west right now. And what I mean by that is they just had a situation where a car dealer in Miami is paying each of the kids on the football team $5,000 apiece in cash just because he wants them to be successful. And it's a business, so it's legal. We can't have that. Most people don't know that kids, especially underprivileged kids, could get up to $15,000 in cash anyway under Pell Grants, under costs of attendance, and a number of other things, which I explained in my book. So I think it's got to be sorted out. I think it's going to dramatically hurt a lot of revenue that the college has been getting from corporate sponsors. So I think there's got to be a way of being able to allow a kid to use the mark of the university, the name of the university. But I think it's also got to be done under governance of the university. I also think that the kids have the ability of, like, in pro players, I mean, there's no reason a kid can't go get so much money for his autograph if you have autograph shows. No reason that you shouldn't have playing cards, just like they do in pro sports, for the kids to have it. But I think in another year or two, this will all come under control, because there'll be a lot of abuses of the system. There'll be a lot of illegal recruiting where a car dealer will make a commitment to a kid. We'll give you a free car if you'll come to Kentucky, for example. Can't do that. Can't use it for recruiting. So it'll get under it. But boy, it should have been done better than it's been done. But it needed to be done.
What do you say to those who've complained that your sports marketing business has exploited college athletes, many of them poor or African-American?
All I got to say to that is that if you didn't have the sports marketing and the corporate sponsor revenue and the signage revenue and advertising revenue that schools have at this point, you would not have most of the non-revenue sports that you have, most of which have benefited underprivileged kids. Look at the track and field program at Kentucky, which has produced several who have a chance to win gold medals at this year's Olympics. And African-American kids deserve every solitary thing coming to them, and they have much greater opportunity today than they've ever had before. But they wouldn't have had any opportunity if universities hadn't had the revenue from primarily the two revenue sports, and that's men's basketball and football. If you didn't have those revenue sources and all the corporate sponsor revenue from it, you would not have then the money to support almost 500 student-athletes at Kentucky, either with full scholarships or partial scholarships and room and board to allow them to have a college education. And what's the value of the college education? Probably today, $25,000, $35,000 a year for every year that you go, in terms of its value today and in the future. So I'm a proponent for what's happened. I'm also a proponent for getting it cleaned up.
Well, you've been immersed in media almost all your life, and it's a shifting landscape constantly. And I wonder what you see resulting from media consumers today shifting from cable and satellite over to the internet and streaming and that kind of thing.
Well, when you have a company like Netflix that wasn't here 10 years ago, when you have Hulu that wasn't here 5 years ago, when you have companies that are streaming companies today and people cutting their cords with cable companies and only getting the content that they want, people are watching more and more shows and movies on the internet than they've ever done before. We've just completed something I've been working on for the last 20 years, Kentucky Wired. We're the first state in the country to complete internet to every county in the state. The next move is to the last mile, and it will change the economic development process of this state dramatically. I just wish I was 30, 40 years younger, knowing what I know now, and talk about being able to build a business. Anybody can build a business now with the internet, and the desire of fans of Kentucky is there. People understand how to capitalize on that, like my old company will be able to do it. I think the future is nothing but bright. And I think those that continue to operate like they always did are going to fail. I think those who understand the new things that they've got the opportunity to take advantage of will succeed.
Who would you say in your adult life, Jim Host, do you think has done the most to advance Kentucky?
Well, I'm not sure I want to answer that only on the basis that there are so many people that have had an impact on my life and so many people that had an impact on Kentucky. It depends upon the time that they were involved.
Mm-hmm.
I think the ones I would mention have all had an impact at a specific time. But today, I think we are held back by our tax structure. I think that if we don't understand why we're the same size fundamentally that we were 10 years ago, and for all intents and purposes, the same size we were 30 years ago, Tennessee's outstripped us because of no state income tax. Georgia's outstripped us because their focus on the genesis of Atlanta and how Atlanta has grown and their airport. I put in my book a chance that this state had to do the same thing Atlanta had in building a massive regional airport. We had that chance 30 years ago by building it between Lexington and Louisville and being the Dallas-Fort Worth. We have missed so many opportunities. So each state has done something that has allowed them to pass Kentucky over a period of time. We got 120 counties. We shouldn't have more than 60. We need to combine some. I mean, it's ludicrous to have Robertson and Metcalf counties that are 5,000 or 6,000 population apiece. I think I'm probably wrong in terms of exact, but I'm close. We should combine the best parts, the education, the fire systems, the police systems, and all that of these counties and the education systems. And if we do that with the new internet now that's coming and the ability of wiring everybody in this state with high-speed internet, we got a chance to do great things in this state if we can change our tax system and be competitive in a tax structure, which we're not competitive of now. Louisville was the same size as Nashville. Look at the difference in the two cities now. And look, we got more inland navigable streams than any state in the United States. We got water. Tell me about the western part of this country that doesn't have water. We got water from a geography point of view. We're 8 hours from England. We're 8 hours from the western part of the hemisphere, from Hawaii, for example. And we got so many opportunities because of our geographical location to leap ahead and become the truly great economic state we can be, and yet preserving our great natural resources we have. So I see nothing but brightness ahead, but we got to get out of our way politically.
And who would you say has done the most for Jim Host?
My wife. We'll be married 32 years this coming May. She's the greatest thing that ever happened to me. She changed me in terms of my approach to a lot of things. So we've never had the first fuss, first disagreement, first argument in the time we've been there. She's the greatest single human being I've ever been around. So I've been blessed with great children. I've been blessed with great grandchildren. But she's the greatest thing that ever happened to me.
All right, Jim Host, thank you so much for all this time you spent with us. We really appreciate it.
Glad to be here, Tom. Thank you.
Jim Host's book, Changing the Game, My Career in Collegiate Sports Marketing, can be found online at Jim Host Book, all one word, jimhostbook.com, or on the website of the University Press of Kentucky. That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage is our executive producer, Wendy Barnett producer, Neil Kesterson producing engineer and audio editor, Ella Fitzgeraldine studio dog. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.